Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here, it's the 14th day of February 2014, Valentine's Day. For those of you who follow that religious holiday, I don't particularly. Agnes got roses, but you know, that's about as far as I take it. Martyred, whatever. Some tie in, I suppose, to the Lupercalia of ancient Rome. But do remember that it took people like Geoffrey Chaucer to gin up the whole romantic love concept associated with this holiday. Until then, it was just a celebration of some cranky people who would not comply with the laws of Rome, who got themselves killed, I guess. Because they, you know, were law-breaking ne'er-do-wells who wanted to impose their way of thinking on the rest of the world. Well, they kind of won, and so consequently, much to the joy of people, of outfits like Hallmark and whatnot, there's a reason to my greeting cards in the middle of February that has nothing to do with presidents or I don't know. My big day this week was Darwin Day. What can I say? Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, Friday on the Front Porch, in which we sort of clear through some leftovers and whatever you want to bring to the table. And we also make a point of having our Friday on the Front Porch Roundtable, welcoming in a whole bunch of people at the same time. We'll get that started here in about an hour or so, or hell, maybe earlier if I feel like it. Let's see. I encourage you, by the way, to, if you haven't in a while, to drop by HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, simply because it's in the process of a little bit of a tweak and a redesign. We've got a brand new media player up there, courtesy of John Fox, and like I said, a story rotator now that where, as time permits, I can jump in and post stories for any given day for your perusal, your delectation, your thoughts, your carrying on, what have you. And, there's a little more function there, I think. I think it's nicer. So run on by. You'll also find the PayPal button at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. And what that does is enables us to continue what we're doing here. It will take us $180 to finish out the week to the good here. So that's 18 folks at 10 bucks a piece, or, well, two at 90, or four at 45, or three at 60, yeah, like pretty much, six at 30, nine at 20. Yeah, that covers most of the bases, doesn't it? But anyway, $180 to finish up the week to the good, and that's just not a whole bunch of money when you think about it. Considering, you know, the websites out there that, you know, produce nothing but text and talk about how they need to raise $20,000 this month and whatever. This is all it takes to keep all of this going. Pretty much one of the biggest broadcast bargains going right now on the interweb tubes. So here we are at here we are at Friday on the front porch this Valentine's Day. And how do you not laugh at something like this? So Bill Nye, the science guy, who has made a career out of introducing the wonderful world of science to children, has been booked onto NBC's Meet the Prestitutes, which means go hang out with MC Rove's dance partner, David Gregory. Bill Nye, the science guy, has been booked on there to debate, no, really, to debate climate change with none other than that titanic genius. I hate audio that starts in a website just for the hell of it. No, he's going to debate that titanic genius of the right wing, Marsha Blackburn. Marsha. Oh, my nose. Goodness. As a friend of mine said on Facebook, and I think there's a hell of a lot of truth in this, and thanks to Sparky, by the way, for posting this to my page so that I would see it and sort of have the hissy that I'm having. Where'd it go? Oh, there it is. Sometimes it's just kind of a pain in the butt to navigate all this stuff. Here we go. My buddy Paul posted in regard to this story. Yes, it's not a joke. Bill Nye, the science guy, really is going to... And if it's anything resembling a fair fight, there won't be anything left of...
goodness!
Marsha Blackburn, but a greasy spot. My buddy Paul said, it's stunning to me that in the gladiatorial realm of confrontational politics... That's a hell of a phrase all by itself now, isn't it? Science and reason are confidently able to send a cartoonish man in a bow tie who teaches little children, secure in the knowledge that he will eviscerate the best minds that the right has to send against him. Which is true. But of course, I don't know. Does Marsha
goodness
Blackburn qualify as the best minds that the right wing has to send? Because if she does, the right wing is in even bigger trouble than maybe even they contemplated.
Goodness.
Bill Nye will argue the pro position, according to Salon, that climate change is real and not a good thing, and Marsha Blackburn,
goodness,
will be arguing the climate change is a made up hoax and not a bad thing, and
Jesus
position. As Alex Perrin at Salon notes, by the end, America will be just a little bit more stupid and doomed. I hope he means that America will be more stupid and doomed because of the stupid effluvium that will be necessitated to be pumped into the atmosphere by Marsha
goodness
Blackburn. Alex is a little pissed off, it seems. He writes, apparently they could not find an actual climate scientist to argue for climate science. It is not particularly surprising that they could not find one to argue against the reality of carbon emissions-driven global warming, but it still seems a bit of an unfair difference in stature to have the position backed up by corporate-sponsored pseudoscience be represented by a member of Congress against a man known primarily for shouting, science! While wearing a bow tie and explaining dinosaurs to daytime public television viewers. Was Thomas Dolby unavailable? Yeah, it's a little harsh on Bill Nye. At least he's not insane, which is something we certainly cannot say about Marsha
goodness
Blackburn. who came up with this? Whose idea is this? And, I mean, David Gregory is some sort of a harumph kind of guy at NBC News, isn't he? Did he not have the power to put the... Hey, wait a minute. No, really, can't we borrow a couple of strippers from Jerry Springer or something? This is silly. Or is he so thoroughly just dredged and dipped in the Beltway bubble grease that he doesn't realize that this is a joke, that anybody with an IQ above freezing is going to see this as nothing short of stupidity? You don't know. No, but realistically, you know what it is. This is nothing more, nothing less than just PR, because people will tune in the way they tune the way they go to NASCAR races to see if somebody crashes. They'll tune in the way people paid for closed circuit television feeds of Evel Knievel on his rocket motorcycle trying to cross the Snake River Canyon. Not because they expect him to do it, or tune in the way they did with that tightrope walker who was walking across a little arm canyon of the Grand Canyon. Not because they want to see him do it. Because they want to see him fail. Now, I'm sure the fundies will be tuning in to see if their great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky will just smite Bill Nye for whatever. But everybody else with two functioning brain cells to rub together will be tuning in for the word salad and the grammar soup and the syntax dessert that will be coming from Marsha
Goodness
Blackburn. Oh, brother, what an idiot. Well, you know what it says in the book. No, it actually doesn't. The idiots ye have always with ye. Truth in that, you know. But we do. We've got a stack, and it would be improper if one of the things that we didn't do was to update on the ongoing disaster that's rolling along here in almost level West by God, Virginia. You knew sooner or later that the right wing would eventually get around to chiming in, and they did, on this disaster, by way of letting the world know that the hillbillies are overreacting. Benedict, our old buddy Benedict, pointed this out to me. It comes, of course, from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Why, it's just chock-a-block full of right-wingers who can pretend that they have answers that they actually do not have. But they talk with their teeth clenched, and the guys clutch at their chest here and call everybody babe. Oh, for heaven's sakes. In this particular instance, it is Competitive Enterprise Institute's senior fellow and chemical policy expert, Angela Logo Massini, Ph.D., who has released a report which the Competitive Enterprise Institute says examines the myths and the facts surrounding the January 9th, 2014 chemical spill. Notice to the folks there in Washington, D.C. at the Competitive Enterprise Institute who didn't have their water poisoned, it's just a spill. And it's a spill that affected 300,000 residents. It's not a chemical disaster that poisoned the water of 300,000 United States citizens. See how it works? Now, until such time, and I said this, I said this on Facebook when it was posted, until such time as Angela Logo Mussini comes down to Charleston, and drinks a quart or two of some nice licorice-smelling water, and can stand there in front of a microphone and say, "Shucks, no, I'm not worried about cancer 10, 15, 20 years from now. I trust the free market water. Yes, Jesus. God bless America, the beautiful national anthem, star-spangled banner. Hooray!" Until she can do that, she needs to shut them up. Lord, here's what Angela Logo Mussini has to say about us hillbillies and our water.
"Contrary to what Americans hear, after such chemical spills, there are plenty of chemical laws and regulations on the books. But West Virginia state and local communities have not implemented them well."
In other words, the hillbillies are too stupid to properly implement laws that have been passed for the management of poison, toxins, deadly chemicals, what have you.
"Unfortunately, adding a new layer of regulation on top of what we have isn't likely to fix the problem. Rather, we need to investigate where officials failed to employ emergency planning measures so that they can minimize the probability of future accidents."
But to be fair to Angela Logo Mussini, there's a little tiny bit of truth in that. No, it is not true that the hillbillies were too stupid to implement the law, as she asserts. I guess they don't have a check your privilege sign at the door of the Competitive Enterprise Institute because, well, you know, being worshippers at the blood-soaked altar of the free market, they don't think that privilege is something that needs to be checked. It needs to be expanded upon. It needs to be celebrated. Just like this jackass who decided to do some speechifying and declared that this whole business of folks out there, one person, one vote concept was just icky. It doesn't afford the necessary due to the job creators and the movers and the shakers. We're talking, of course, about venture capitalist Tom Perkins, who may be worth a lot of money, but in terms of intellect and common decency and morals and ethics, is not worth the powder and lead it would take to blow him up. It was a meeting of the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Speaking at the Commonwealth Club, and we're going to get back to Angela Logo Mussini here in a minute. This guy, for some reason or another, was given a microphone and asked to spew the fecal matter that exists in his brain out onto the people in attendance. He said, "The Tom Perkins system is you don't get to vote unless you pay a dollar of taxes. But what I really think is it should be like a corporation. You pay $1 million in taxes, you get 1 million votes. How's that?" And, of course, the polite audience in San Francisco, little golf claps, and they tittered and chuckled. Hey, wait a minute. Yeah, this is the same asshat who said that the 1% in America are the very same thing as oppressed Jewry. during the Third Reich in Nazi Germany.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So here's a guy who laughingly talks about, well, laughingly talks about how the corporations need to just pick our political leaders for us because, well, you know, money. It's disgusting. One of the telltale signs, though, is in his remarks, he says something along the lines of, well, of course, when we started the country, we said that only people who owned property could vote. Well, that didn't last long, and pretty soon the vote was given to everyone. And the reason I mention this is because in the course of talking about privilege over here at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, well, this is a privilege issue, too, because what this guy meant, I mean, he was speaking his truth. Voting laws were modified so that non-property owners could vote, but what he meant when he said everybody could vote, which actually didn't happen until 1964 and after, and for which we are still engaged in struggle, what he meant was that every white male could vote. And in the world of Tom Perkins, that is everyone, because that is the nature of his privilege. Women? Mm-mm. Persons of color? Mm-mm. Natives who've been here for 10, 15, 20,000 years? No. Whether they got to vote or not, that was beside the point. But don't think for an instant that Tom Perkins is somehow alone or that this is a novelly developed weirdo right-wing theory. Oh, hell no. Because, weren't we, a couple of nights ago, about the fact that the people who founded this country really did think that the only people who needed to be voting were people who had money and property. One of the lead proponents among that group was, of course, Alexander Hamilton, who didn't want the hoi polloi out there messing up his good thing. And if it weren't for the fact that Alexander Hamilton was a miserable asshat and couldn't resist saying tawdry things about Aaron Burr's family, he might have lived to try to advocate for that some more, but instead he said tawdry things, got called out, and got killed over on the plains of Weehawken. Yeah, but anyway, back to Angela Logo Mussini, who notes that she says we need to investigate where officials failed to employ emergency planning measures so that they can minimize the probability of future accidents. There is an element of truth to that. There is no truth to the fact that hillbillies are too goddamn dumb, as she asserts, to be able to apply laws. But there is truth to the fact that things were implemented poorly because, after all, Earl Ray Tomblin, Governor Earl Ray Tomblin, or as we like to call him, Gert did not issue any sort of order through his military and public safety homeland security director, Jimmy Giannotto, who has apparently this dim view of chemical disasters, where he says, I don't think it was much of nothing. That's what he said when 100,000 gallons of toxic poison got dumped in Fields Creek and eventually found its way down to the Kanawha River and started working its way west. No, Gert really didn't order the water system shut down, so naturally all of that poison flowed through everybody's house, everybody's business, everybody's everything, and occasioned the shutdown of every business and school and emergency measures at hospitals and nursing homes in a 9-county area. So she has a point there. But it is a point that is not well taken, because her argument about employing emergency planning measures so they can minimize the probability of future accidents, that's bull. Because this state is run on principles
that are hand in glove with the free market fantasies and sick pornographic dreams of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. They're a little late getting out with this, claiming that, you're going to love this. This is a little bit of hippie punching, if you will.
Misinformation abounds related to the recent chemical spill in Charleston, West Virginia.
Well, I'd say the first statement of misinformation is claiming that it was just a chemical spill. It's a goddamn disaster in which 300,000 people had their water poisoned, but Angela Logo Mussini can't check her privilege long enough to figure that out, and she's not down here, and she doesn't have to bathe an infant in it, and she doesn't have to make formula with it, and she doesn't have to worry about her mama or her daddy being poisoned by it or breathing the fumes. No. She's far, far away in her right-wing privilege bubble. But she says that the misinformation is driven by opportunistic environmental activists who are using this unfortunate event. Really? It's unfortunate? No, goddammit, Angela Logo Mussini. It is an act of gross, willful, wanton, reckless negligence on the part of the people that you think are best suited to run this country. You know, the money folks that were over there running the improperly inspected, barely inspected at all, utterly unregulated tank farms full of coal cleaning chemicals.
Driven by opportunistic environmental activists who are using this unfortunate event.
Yes, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate when the first drink of liquid your newborn who has just come home from the hospital gets is laced with poison.
It's unfortunate. They're using this unfortunate event as an excuse to push legislation that is largely unrelated to the spill.
You mean the disaster, Angela Logo Mussini? How much do they pay you to write this shit?
In particular, some say the federal government needs to strengthen the Federal Toxic Substances Control Act because the spill underscores the need for more information about chemicals.
And, of course, she couldn't disagree more. She says TSCA governs reporting, record-keeping, and testing requirements and restrictions relating to chemical substances and or mixtures. Myth.
This spill is a major environmental catastrophe.
Fact. Emergency planning failures are evident, but we need to place the scope of this problem in perspective. Come on, Bob. Come on, Bob. Now, you were raised better, Bob. You know, you don't just hit people because you don't like what they say. You don't even want to hit people. Remember, Bob, hate is one of the most powerful human emotions, and it can often do as much damage to the person, more damage to the person doing the hating than the person being hated. Yeah, yeah. Because, see, the stupid hillbillies, the stupid hillbillies lack perspective. Because, see, that's what it is. When mama's bathing her baby and the water smells like licorice, and then you find out that you bathed your baby and made formula and stuff for the baby with poisoned water, and you begin to ask, my God, what have I done to my child? Because no one would turn the water off, and people waited 8 to 10 hours to tell us that the water was poisoned. See, that's a perspective problem is what that is.
The chemical spill in West Virginia presents serious issues and concerns about chemical risks and emergency planning failures.
See, it was government that failed, not the goddamn tank farm. It wasn't
the free market's fault. It wasn't capitalism's fault because, well, capitalism's like Jesus and it has no flaws.
It created hardships within the local communities that include stress, short-term health effects, and adverse economic impacts. But fortunately, the health risks were short-term and limited in scope.
Because what, Angela Logo Mussini has a goddamn crystal ball and can look out into the future and knows for a fact that nobody who drank or breathed that poison will ever wind up sitting in some sort of examination gown in a doctor's office with a doctor looking at them and in grave, serious tones saying, well, you got cancer. Why do I have cancer? Remember the chemical spill? Yeah, probably that. Because that's just never going to happen because Angela Logo Goddamn Mussini at the Competitive Enterprise Institute is all-knowing, all-seeing, and can predict that kind of thing with absolute 100% certainty. And Angela, what are the effing lottery numbers for tonight? I need to know. I hate this stuff.
Consider some facts about the case. On January 9th, 2013, officials from the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection discovered that one of Freedom Industries' chemical tanks at the West Charleston, West Virginia-based Etowah River Terminal was leaking a chemical mixture called crude MCHM, which was blended with a small amount of a chemical called PPH. The tank had released an estimated 10,000 gallons of the chemical, which entered a nearby waterway that leads down to the intake point for the city.
A nearby waterway. It's called the Elk River, Angela. Or where you come from, are rivers just little toxic waste transportation conduits? Well, I mean, she works for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and they support industries and poisoners and killers and murderers and giant negligence factories. So maybe, yeah, maybe that's what a river is to Angela.
It's a conduit. After traveling downriver, the chemical reached the intake port for the community's water supply facility and then was piped out to residences before water utility officials realized what had happened. As soon as they learned about the spill, local officials quickly issued water advisories and provided bottled water to the community.
Bullshit. That is not how it happened. That is not how it happened at all. They knew this poison was going into the river no later than the 11 o'clock hour of January the 9th, and still The don't drink it order didn't go out for 4 hours.
But see, the for-profit water company traded on the publicly traded. They provided bottled water.
You ever tried to fill up a bathtub with bottled water? Did you ever take a? Yeah, you get the idea. Now, just dig this reasoning.
Although official numbers are not yet available, Ken Ward of the Charleston Gazette reported that public officials placed that number at between 450 and 500 cases of water.
Oh, I'm sorry, no, 450 and 500 cases of people getting sick from the poison!
If that is true, the spill resulted in short-term health effects among 0.17% of the population. And, you know, that's just a statistic, and that's what those little hillbillies are. They're just statistics. F them. We do not have a final case count.
And, Angela, you won't for 20 years. Come on down. Come on down, Angela. Come on down and live with us hillbillies. Drink that water, and let's see how you like it when maybe you're the one getting the serious look from the doctor.
Well, that's all right if I've got the cancer because I got the cancer for the free market, and capitalism is my Lord and Savior.
And And then she just enters the realm of absolutely errant mendacity.
The water utility flushed its system, and within days it no longer posed a significant threat to the local tap water as the levels dropped considerably.
What levels? What's considerably? Because you see, Angela, up there in your little privilege bubble,
no one knows what the safe levels are.
Because there had never been any sort of sufficient testing to establish what those levels should be. There was one miserable standard, one miserable lethal dose 50% standard that resulted in a hastily arrived at conclusion of one part per million, when in fact this stuff is still detectable at 10 parts per billion.
In the environment, the chemical will break down quickly, according to Rolf Halden, professor of engineering at Arizona State University and adjunct association professor at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. He explained on National Public Radio that the chemical would disappear from the water. Poof! Within a couple of weeks, and from the soil within a month. I would not be terribly concerned about long-term contamination of the environment with this chemical, he said. Okay, so that's great. So we can just keep on using it. Using it down in those little hillbilly mountaintop removal communities. Because, you know, they're hillbillies, and even if we gave them good regulations, being hillbillies and stupid and everything, like I've said, they wouldn't know how to implement the laws properly. So what's the point in having laws? Although the situation is not the catastrophe the media hype suggests,
what media hype? How would Competitive Enterprise Institute even know? Has this even been covered over on Radio TV Rwanda?
Lacking a spill and emergency management plan, local officials were not fully prepared to communicate the risks associated with this particular chemical.
Well, Angela, I wonder why that was. Because see, Angela, the U.S. Chemical Safety Board offered a plan to the state of West Virginia, to the Earl Ray Tomlin administration, that would have possibly, likely prevented this disaster. But because people like the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation and all these other freakish right-wing sick bastard alleged think tanks preach against regulation, preach against government, preach against civil society, inveigh against the precautionary principle, because of all that, well, the Earl Ray administration didn't want to implement that plan because it might offend the money. So, gee, I wonder why there was no plan.
Myth. The spill offers... Spill. It's just a spill. See, this morning, my kitty cat walked across the table just as I was pouring my coffee, and some of my coffee spilled on the floor, and I just wiped it up with a paper towel. And, you know, I didn't cry. I didn't ask for FEMA to come in. It's just a spill. This spill offers evidence that regulation of the chemical industry is not strict enough.
Fact. Myriad regulations exist, but state and local officials failed to implement them correctly.
Is the Competitive Enterprise Institute in the same building with the National Rifle Association? Because this is the same argument we get every time we try to keep another 9-year-old from being prevented from becoming a 10-year-old.
We have plenty of laws on the books. The problem ain't that we ain't got enough laws, is we ain't enforcing the laws. Put them bastards in jail. The only thing that'll stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
One-trick pony is the right wing.
Myth. The material safety data sheet provides little useful information about the chemical.
Fact.
The MSD has contained enough information to ensure proper and safe handling of the chemical, which is what it is designed to do.
Even though the box that said carcinogenic, no data. Mutagenic, no data.
And, well, you hillbillies don't need all that information. Just, you know, don't put it in your coffee unless the free markets put it in there for you. Some news accounts portrayed the MSDS for crude MCHM,
she says MCMHCH,
as being grossly inadequate because it does not detail all the potential risks, particularly the potential long-term risks and complete toxicological data to consumers or workers. But it is inappropriate.
What a word.
It is inappropriate to use this document as evidence that we do not know enough about this chemical because the MSDS is not designed to contain all that information.
How about any information, Angela?
You harpy. Rather, it's designed to communicate imminent hazards to workers and provide guidelines.
So if it's mutagenesis and carcinogenesis and it just says, we don't know,
well, that's enough for the little proles. If they get some on them, well, then we'll maybe find out now, won't we? See how the free market works? It is true that some lines in at least one version, there are several formats for these forms. You know, I mean, there's the Microsoft Word format, and there's the PDF format, and then there's the format that's written in Linear B.
Of the MSDS say, no data available.
But that does not mean no data exists about the mixture's components, or that we need to worry when exposure is controlled according to the guidelines in the data sheet.
Gee, Angela! You idiot! Do you suppose that exposure was controlled according to the guidelines in the data sheet when Freedom Industries dumped 10,000 gallons of this, no two ways about it, freaking poison into the public water supply? Angela, do you think that was controlled according to the guidelines in the data sheet? What, do you live in a bell jar, Angela?
I'm beginning to think this woman has tequila on her cornflakes in the morning.
Myth. We do not have enough information about the risks associated with this chemical.
Fact.
We do know that limited and short-term exposure to crude MCHM poses little to no long-term public health risk.
The only thing is, we don't really have a proper understanding of what limited or short-term exposure is. I mean, for instance, take the lifespan of a two-day-old, newborn, who's been alive for 2 days on planet Earth and then spends 5 minutes in this water getting its first bath. That five-minute segment is a significant long-term exposure as compared to 48 hours of life, right? Not according to Angela, because, well, that baby just needs to give it up for capitalism. Ooh, yeah, glory.
The dose truly makes the poison.
What is this? The proof is in the pudding?
Public exposure to crude MCHM is too low to pose any long-term health risks, and worker exposure is managed by proper work practices regulated under OSHA.
I mentioned to you the guy that I was talking to the other night as I was flying home from New York to Charleston. We were in Atlanta, and he said, I've been walking around in this stuff, exposed to this stuff, contact with this stuff for years and years and years, and nobody ever told me it was toxic. I am scared to death.
The only time the public experiences any exposure to this chemical, which is designed for industrial use only, is in the case of spills, because we're going to pretend that southern West Virginia and the mountaintop removal sacrifice zone just doesn't exist. All those hillbillies are imaginary creatures like unicorns and hobbits and leprechauns. Right. As this case shows, such exposure was short-term, temporary, and quickly managed. That's why people are still smelling the stench of the fumes of this noxious poison. There are no long-term risks from these exposures, since health effects like cancer, which I will not get because I wouldn't touch that area with a 20-foot pole, a 200-mile-long pole. I wouldn't come down there. I'm Angela Langostino, and I live in a privilege bubble. It is also worth noting that this chemical has been used safely for decades without any evidence of serious health effects, which offers some indication that its risks can be managed and the chemical used safely. Yes, of course, because that chemical was part of the chemicals that were pumped into underground sludge injections and pumped up behind vast seas of toxic waste in southern West Virginia near places like Printer Holler, where there were six houses side by side, all of whom got a member of each household of whom got a form of brain cancer that occurs once in 100,000. Because, you see, it takes prolonged high-level exposure for cancer to kick in. And nobody's ever been hurt by this chemical that we know of, and we're damn sure not going to go and look. Because, see, we're the competitive effing Enterprise Institute, and our job is to carry water, whether it's poison or not, for the free market, and make sure that it has primacy over the needs of actual, real, live, breathing human beings, filthy little proles. There is no toxicological data on crude MCHM. Fact. Both the federal government and the manufacturer have conducted numerous tests that indicate low toxicity. The manufacturer Eastman Chemical voluntarily submitted 13 studies on crude MCHM during the 1990s to the EPA. The company explains on its website that it did not originally release this data to the public because it was proprietary, and it did not want to provide it to competitors for free. Because, you see, money is more important. Shareholder profits are more important than people's well-being. Yay, capitalism!
This goes on and on and on.
Myth. Government officials cannot say that the public is safe after the spill. Fact. Public officials failed to place risk in perspective and emphasize the fact that long-term health effects are negligible.
Because Angela knows this, even though the rest of the world doesn't. Because Angela's the freaking queen of the May.
She knows because she trusts the unseen hand of the free market. And it pets her on her pointy little head from time to time.
Yeah, see, that's the problem.
We got mountains in Appalachia, and we got some poison streams, and we got some blown-away mountains that have turned into flat moonscapes, and I mean, you know, we got some banjo pickers and whatnot, but what we don't have is perspective. That's what we need, some perspective. I was just up there at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and they're just swimming in it. They got lots of perspective up there, and their perspective is that the money is a hell of a lot more important than any goddamned hillbilly is.
Stupid hillbillies. You don't have any perspective. Why, I bet you toothless freaks can't even spell it. Myth. West Virginians may also be exposed to dangerous levels of the cancer-causing formaldehyde, which is a byproduct of MCHM.
Fact.
There is no evidence that MCHM breakdown had led to any significant release of formaldehyde. Because I said so. Because money. Because that's what I'm paid to say.
Now, this is all against the backdrop of an actual honest-to-God scientist saying that, yeah, there's formaldehyde.
Dr. Letitia Tierney, who's in the bag for Earl Ray Tomlin, called Simonton's claims totally, totally unfounded, as well as misleading and irresponsible, for good reason. As she explained to reporters, Simonton is not part of any official investigation related to the spill. He doesn't have a big board. He doesn't have a badge. He doesn't have a little thing hanging off of a lanyard that says part of the official investigation. He's just some science-y guy who went out and tested the water and found formaldehyde, so F him. I mean, Letitia Tierney said she can't validate his tests.
Never mind the fact that she probably lacks the skill set to do that with.
I mean, she noted that MCHM would need to be heated to 500 degrees Fahrenheit before it would break down into formaldehyde.
And we can trust Letitia Tierney, but we can't trust Scott Simonton because Angela Key Largo says we can.
Myth, this is another example of greedy,
in quotation marks, no less. Wonder who she's quoting.
Chemical companies profiting while exposing consumers to dangerous chemicals.
How about citizens, Angela? Can you say citizens just one time?
No, not really, Bob, because you're just there to eat and excrete and die. That's what we believe here at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Fact. Chemical companies profit when they provide products that are safe and beneficial to a large number of consumers.
You mean like 300,000 who get the shit dumped in their water?
The idea that somehow people who work in chemical industries or for-profit firms do not care about the impact of their products is absurd and is belied by the fact that they and their families are exposed to these chemicals too.
Right, because we live in a world where you have to sacrifice things like your family, your family's health, your family's well-being, if you want to make enough money to put food on the table until your family dies. Ain't capitalism great?
We also should not ignore the value these technologies deliver. Crude MCHM provides society with important benefits that outweigh the risks. In this case, crude MCHM is used because it helps make the coal burn cleaner.
Bullshit. There's no such thing as clean coal. It's an advertising slogan. It's always been an advertising slogan. It is never going to be a scientific fact because it's filthy. Go talk to the folks over there along the Dan River in North Carolina and Virginia about how much cleaner MCHM helped the coal to burn. Because I'm sure that no small amount of that crap coming out of that pond through that pipe into that Dan River
was cleaned with crude MCHM, which is a benefit to society. It helps the coal burn cleaner, producing less air pollution, but not less enough air pollution to keep from cooking the planet. Well, you know, they called me on the...
Why not let Miss Angela, Dr. Angela, who couldn't put a Band-Aid on somebody without killing them, let Dr. Angela debate Bill Nye, the science guy over there on Meet the Prestitutes, how about?
Oh, no, I'll be washing my hair that morning. We should not lose perspective.
Well, you know, we're hillbillies. We can't lose what we don't already have, and you've already made it clear that we don't have any, Angela, but anyway.
We should not lose perspective of the value that chemical technologies provide when an accident happens.
Really? Chemical technologies provide value when an accident happens?
Yes, look at all the people. Look at all the people who got jobs, had jobs cleaning up this mess. See how it works? Unseen hand. Instead, we need to turn our attention to finding ways to better manage the risks so we can continue to enjoy the benefits.
You know, Sarian, really, won't you please eat this cotton, this chocolate-covered cotton ball? It'll be good for the corporation, and everybody has a share.
Oh, good God. The chemical spill in West Virginia points out the need for improved emergency planning and communications. Because, see, as long as we're doing this kind of stuff, there's going to be emergencies, all right? Mostly at the local government level. I mean, none of the people that we support, none of the right-wing freaks or anything, no, they didn't have anything to do with this. All that hollering about deregulation that we do all the time, this is just a little local failure of emergency management. That's what this is. I mean, never mind that there's all kinds of toxic chemicals all over the Kanawha Valley, and that Charleston almost got Bhopal'd 6 years ago. Because after all, toxic chemicals provide value. They provide value during a disaster. The focus on unrelated debates such as reforms to the Toxic Substances Control Act will do nothing to improve the public safety. Nothing. You can trust us. Jesus, Mary and Joseph. You know what's sad, though? Angela would have written something very similarly if there had been 300,000 bodies floating down the Kanawha River. Well, this wasn't capitalism's fault. This isn't the free market's fault. I mean, this is those hillbillies and they lack a perspective. I mean, why did they have to drink water anyway? What kind of broken brain do you have if you can go to work every day and do what that awful, awful, hateful, disgusting, revolting woman does? I don't know if she's reproduced. I rather hope she hasn't and doesn't. But assuming that she has, you think she'd get out there and give her baby a bath in MCHM-laced water because she was taking one for the... letting her baby take one for the team because, well, you know, the free market has to be... Yeah. I mean, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, right? So that's, and we're not even done with the chemical disaster update. Wait till you see the, well, if we get to it, when we check out the fact list that was sent out by state government about crude MCHM. It was sent out for healthcare professionals to use in counseling their patients. It's a real hoot. Thanks very much to Gene. Gene got us started this evening, taking us down to only 165 to go to finish the week to the good. And then Thomas took us down to only 115 to go to finish the week to the good. So we're off to a rousing start. And all we need, that means 10 at 10, 2 at 54, 25, and a little bit of change. But we can do this evening, and every week, every time we finish the week in the good, it's a little more likely that the next month happens. Because this is and has been a month-to-month operation. Note coming in from Ron in Raleigh,
it's obvious to me that Ms. Messina, or whatever her name is on the grift. She will say anything to stay in the flow of cash on the free market right. I can't wait for her article on the Duke Power coal ash spill in the Dan River. I'd love to sit this woman down in front of a glass of water and put one drop of crude MCHM in it and dare her to chug it. Drink, 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 drink. It was a lot more fun getting that done to you with beer involved, but yeah, you get the idea. Oh no, Irish Dave, what? See, this is what makes this program so much fun. You guys run off and research things that that I would never even dream of looking up. Irish Dave with a note. Did you realize Angela Logo Messini got her start working for Sam Brownback? You remember Sam Brownback. He's the governor of Kansas. He was a senator from Kansas. He's all Jesused up and wants to make sure that the ladies stay in their places and that he maintains control of how the lady parts work and all of that. Really, she did. Oh, my God. Irish Dave also pointing out, you know, Bob, even the Holy First Amendment doesn't permit shouting formaldehyde in a crowd something, something, because freedom! Wolverines! Jesus. So it is time to get started on our Friday on the Front Porch Roundtable. You are welcome to participate as you deem fit. One easy way is to participate in the Horn Malloy Skype chat group, and that is moderated by our longtime moderator and Horn Malloy Skype chat group co-creator, Sparky. If you'd like to join in, send a contact on Skype to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, and he can work you into the process whereby you will join in that way. And there are every Friday night four, we've got more than four, but that's how this machine works. We've got four phone lines that can be utilized for purposes of participating in the Friday on the Front Porch discussion. 304-658-3333 is how you get through to any and all of them. Jump right in. It should be a rousing good conversation. It's always a rousing good conversation on Friday on the Front Porch. 304-658-3333, or join in the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. This is Conversation Radio. This is something that doesn't happen in many other places that I know of. This is a place where people who carry this country on their back, workaday Americans, get treated like the experts that they are. And I think that makes things, yeah, this is a definite departure from the typical format. Which means, all in all, this is the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Try to remember.
from the Transverse City album. Warren Zevon, the late great, and Run Straight Down. Yeah, that's a fascinating. That song just kind of grabbed because there's that whole litany of all those toxic, poisonous chemicals that Angelo Logo Mussini, former employee of Sam Brownback, says, you know,
are perfectly good for human beings as long as I'm cashing the check.
Yeah. It is Friday on the front porch, and we are filling up the phone lines, and the Skype group is on board. Plenty of room. Well, two lines remaining in the traditional telephone line connection, and plenty of room left in the Horn Molloy Skype chat group for you to jump in if you wish, and I encourage you and invite you to. Let's get it all going. Let's start with the Skype group. Mouseketeer roll call. Good evening, Sparky.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, and we have Sentient.
Hello.
Hey, how are you? Grant is with us.
Hey, Bob.
And Waggy is with us.
Hello, hello.
All righty, and let's move over and check the phones now. Hey, welcome to the Friday on the Front Porch.
Good evening.
Good evening, Bill. Stand by, please. Mm-hmm. Welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
Talking to me, Bob?
I'm talking to you. Is this Dan?
This is Dan.
All right, cool. Welcome aboard. And welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
Hello.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
And how are you tonight, sir?
I'm pretty well, so that means we've got one line remaining open for Friday on the Front Porch on the telephone side and plenty of room. I see Jay Cruzen entering into the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. I want to ask people with a science background, because I took my obligatory core science classes in college and try to remain at least moderately literate on these topics.
Mm-hmm.
But was Angelo Logo Mussini as full of shit as a Christmas goose? Waggy,
yeah,
you want to take that one?
I think she was, and I think they're all they everything that they've been saying consistently has been an effort to diminish the impact of this disaster, also the North Carolina issues, and was there not a big badass explosion somewhere?
That would be Knifley, Kentucky, two nights ago.
Knifley, Kentucky, yes, where someone spoke of not having been shaken like that, even in the military with their
yeah. He said he'd had 20
explosions.
Yeah, he'd had 20 years in the military and had never seen an explosion like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was shaking. It was shaking house foundations 25 miles away.
Yeah.
Boy, he's pretty lucky.
I'd say, and of course they had to. Well, I mean, it even rained great hunks of pipeline down on people.
No, that's no fun, Bob. Let me tell you.
I don't take any convincing on that, Jim.
By the way, this woman is like a goose that you nailed to the floor, and you stuff feed her. You know, and instead of getting pate out of her, you get shit.
Well, she certainly seems that way. But this, you know, this notion that the reason this disaster, one, she can't bring herself to call it a disaster. Two, she can't bring herself to call it poison, which it is. But, I mean, really? Really? 300,000 people get their water poisoned, and she blames us for lack of perspective?
If it looks like a duck, if it talks like a duck, and it walks like a duck, it is a duck.
No, I tend to concur. Waggy, any thoughts on it?
I'm afraid I missed the details earlier.
Well, no, just this this woman from the Competitive Enterprise Institute who says that West Virginia Freedom Industries coal cleaning chemical disaster is being horribly, horribly overblown, and that nobody's ever going to get sick from this because it was very limited exposures, and we had plenty of information about the chemical.
Oh yeah, that's a load of all, and on all counts.
Because
they don't, they have no idea what the exposure is.
Right, and she,
nobody does.
Right, so how can you say that exposure was limited when, I mean, just by comparison, for instance, a teeny tiny drop of lysergic acid diethylamide will make you see the walls breathe and the sky turn paisley. But that's a limited exposure too, isn't it?
Right. Well, which brings you to the second point, which is nobody knows what this does to human beings because it's never been tested until now, and now we'll find out. I can guarantee you that there are people with proposals in to do longitudinal studies on samples of the population.
Well, they have
specifically to figure it out.
They have finally begun doing some testing in some homes, and
well, that's just what the levels are now. They can also it's probably somewhat fat soluble, so they can probably also test human tissue to figure out past exposure to some degree. And there are probably folks who are working on it now, but it's got to be funded and you know resources put in place and all the rest of that.
And I mean. Should people feel like that they have a right to be kept, to, you know, medical monitoring, as the phrase is used in current parlance, that they have a right to be checked out periodically to see if they're still okay?
I think most countries in Europe would kind of take that as a given, yeah, because we don't know what it's going to do, and regular checkups are one way to find out if there is any shift in the population of exposed versus unexposed people.
Hmm.
Well, yeah, for example, you, Mr. Kincaid, would be a comparable population unexposed with the counties next door being exposed for comparison.
Right.
Can I interrupt for a minute, Bob?
Yeah, jump in.
Tracy came into the Skype group, but I don't know if she can see our chat.
I can hear you.
Yeah, but if you're not talking, you need to stay muted because your background noise.
Okay, I will mute.
All right.
And then if you want to chime in, just unmute and jump in.
Okey-doke.
And well, let me ask this next question then, because you know we've been a toxic canary in the coal mine for a very long time in West Virginia and Central Appalachia generally. How do you even follow up on the health effects of this stuff when there's so much other crap that we're dealing with? I mean, the Kanawha Valley has had elevated cancer rates for ages.
Right, that's why I was saying tissue samples now or urine samples or whatever may be able to detect recent exposure to try to put that in. It's a matter of collecting a lot of data from as many people as possible, both in affected and unaffected areas, and then crunching the data down the road and doing this over a period of decades, lifetimes.
Can you just roughly guesstimate, Waggy, what kind of money we're talking about? I mean, are we talking about millions, tens of millions of dollars?
Yeah, millions is a minimum. I'm trying to. I have no idea what the long-term nurses study costs. That's kind of the benchmark for long-term studies where they followed nurses from when they got their license to all the way, and you know they lived out their entire natural lives and collected lots and lots of data. That's where a lot of women's health population conclusions came from. Is that? And something similar would need to be done here. But with a sample size of like a couple thousand. Because it's a matter of comparing things. You know, there's counties like where you're in that are, you know, not affected. And there are the counties that are affected. And then, yes, both have elevated cancer incidences from common sources. But you try to differentiate what the affected folks have versus what the unaffected ones have. It's all very sciencey. It takes a long time. And, yeah, millions would be a way to put a ballpark on it. But that's what the CDC does. That's what the health service does. And that's under Homeland Security. So that's money is there for doing that kind of stuff.
Would you care to put odds on it happening?
It's at the federal level, and they're not quite as beholden to coal as your state. I'm not saying that they don't have any effect, but there. I was just talking earlier with someone. The federal government is actually more influenced by the folks who make money off of disasters. So they'll also have influence to get these things done because that's money in their pockets to get the studies done, to get the funding done, especially for new tests, because this particular chemical doesn't have a specific test, and I'm sure somebody would love to develop it, and again, is probably putting in a proposal right now to get funded to do research to do just that. A company, a testing company that wants money to figure out a cheap and quick way to do the testing that's needed.
May I ask something?
Go right ahead, Jim. Go right ahead, Jim.
I just wonder what type of contractors they will use and what type of conclusions they will draw. If you use a private contractor and you have a local private contractor or whatever, or any other contractor who's paid by the government, exactly what the level of veracity of their findings would be.
Now, most of the stuff is in conjunction with universities, and there's always skullduggery, but hopefully more than one agency and business and university and other organizations will get involved so that there's some way to try to balance them against each other. It's hard to really control everyone in the, you know, that gets involved. And there will be folks doing it. Because people, you know, students need their thesis for their dissertations, and toxicologists and public health people who, you know, have been, who want to and are good at researching this kind of stuff will be ready to jump on it.
So when this woman, this PhD, publishes this vile load of garbage, I don't understand the mind of somebody like that.
The University of Texas at Austin is full of people that do that, and they're pretty much just laughed at, although they're kept on staff because they bring fame, notoriety to the institution.
And so she's just cashing the check. I mean, she'd blame the hillbillies is okay as long as the check clears. I mean, I guess I'm asking questions of morals and ethics because it seems like this woman has none.
Is she from the UT?
No. She's from the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Okay.
But according to Irish Dave, she once worked for Senator Sam Brownback.
Okay.
Oh, well, good luck with her.
That's a pretty compelling case for, you know, not having any.
Yeah, any woman who would work for Sam Brownback is pretty self-loathing from jump, isn't she?
But unemployment hits people with advanced degrees too, and you got to feed your family.
Wow. It just...
And they do have people who, shall we say, lean upon them to let them know where their paycheck comes from, and a lot of people are intimidated by this unless they're independently wealthy and they don't have to depend on that money from contractor or whomever. That's just the real world. Sorry.
Bill, you were going to say something a minute ago, or were saying something?
No, wasn't me.
Oh, okay.
Change.
That might have been me, Bob. You know, when you listen to these people, it seems to me that they're very good at rhetorically deflecting. It's called deking in hockey and faking in basketball and cutting in football. We know these terms if we follow those particular sports. But rhetorically speaking, these people are very good at deflecting and shaking and baking away from responsibility. They are professional victims. If you debate them at all on a one-to-one basis, ultimately it'll come around to their victimhood. Even if they're subtle about it, it almost always comes around. That's part of their Frank Luntz playbook. And what I heard in the last month is nothing more than more of the very same. And I think that's what you insist on calling. And by the way, I have to compliment you before I forget for restraining yourself from not launching yourself over the table and grabbing that guy's throat from the
Union of Concerned Scientists.
Yeah, talking about his brother in the coal mining business. Oh God, you know, I thought, oh, shut up, mister, shut up. But you acquitted yourself very well, Bob.
Well, it was just kind of dichotomous to me because I get emails from the Union of Concerned Scientists all the time talking about what a nightmare, and it's true, what a nightmare coal is.
Yeah.
And like I said last night, Dan, I just don't understand why it is that there's this. I mean, there's this mindset that says we have to say something. It's I don't know. Is it out of kindergarten? You know. Well, okay, we're going to offer a critique, but first we have to say something nice about them.
I had tea with a neighbor this morning, and she said this morning, as she has said before, that she likes to listen to both sides. And I laid a bunch of facts on her that essentially had her listening. Not the least of which, now this is a school teacher. She teaches art and she coaches after sports after school. And she has expressed exasperation at schools being underfunded and students coming to school underfed or not fed at all, too many students on the roster per classroom. And when I told her just one figure out of Davos a couple of weeks ago, 85 human beings owning as much wealth as half of the world's population, she had not heard that. And when you lay a couple of salient facts on these people, I think it knocks them back a peg and gets them to thinking. I also told her that Syracuse is home to one of the Forbes 400 who has escaped his real taxes in lieu of two pilots that extended first 25 years and now 20. So this guy escapes his real tax bill for almost half a century. I told her that between 87 and 2007, the Forbes 400 wealthiest Americans net worth went up eightfold, from an average of $200 million per person to $1.6 billion per person on that list. And she did not know that. So when you but she agreed that the concentration of wealth is obviously a problem. But if you have a couple of those convenient facts, it generally stalls the nonsense out of the right wing mouth. And I like to call up a couple of these facts when I'm engaged in a one-to-one conversation, or usually it's a one-on-two-or-three conversation, but it's useful. It's useful information, and I pull it out when I'm a bit of a sniper in that respect, but they have it coming. They've stolen the national conversation for far too long, and it's time we fought back with real facts and let their heads stew in a little bit of reality for a change. Instead of their fantasy world, I think you've been referring to it recently, Bob, as their the hustle.
Yes.
That they pull out of their hip pocket all the time, and they've been doing that forever. Frank Luntz and his death tax, and when I let her know that in 2010, the estate tax went away completely, and George Steinbrenner's kid inherited the Yankees for nothing out of his pocket. That stopped her cold. And this guy never had to mow the lawn. He never had to clear the dinner dishes.
Well, I'm getting it. I just got hipped to a little bit of information on this Angela Logo Massini creature.
Yeah.
It turns out she's not a scientist at all, remotely, even a little bit.
Just a mouthpiece.
She has a Ph.D. in politics from Catholic University of America. And yet she feels, I was talking about the privilege bubble before.
Yeah.
No, this is a privilege terrarium or something. Because here is a non-scientist hiding under the guise of science, pretending to be able to tell people who have been poisoned to shut up and quit complaining.
May I say something, Bob?
Yeah, jump in, Jim.
Have you any idea of how much influence that the accountants lobby has in Congress?
I imagine they're a significant lobby.
Oh, it's very.
They've been able to hold off the flat tax, as far as I can tell, because,
well,
you know,
they've been able to do a lot of things, and they've been able to enable the people who support them and their influence upon Congress to open as many loopholes for people who make a lot of money and then shut them for people who, unfortunately, do not. and therefore there's a great deal of transfer of the tax burden from those who should be paying it to, unfortunately, to those who have to pay it or those who have to suffer.
Well, I think...
I don't know what's going on with the telephone line, but again, Jim is very faint in my ear, and maybe we're sharing the same circuit. But
I'm having a lot of trouble hearing Dan. Is it Dan?
Yeah, y'all are on the same hybrid.
Yeah, hey yeah. Dan, how you doing?
Very well, Jim. I think, Bob, you've mentioned this book before, and I've read it and shared it with several people that have come back with high praise for it. David K. Johnston's Perfectly Legal.
Oh, yes.
The U.S. tax code?
Yeah, that's like cold water in the face.
Oh, my God. That is a magnificent book to really educate folks on what the little subtle language embedded in the tax code and how wealthy people hire smart lawyers and accountants to find mm-hmm. those loopholes for themselves. And the opening couple of paragraphs describe Jonathan Blotmacher getting into a private jet and flying off to some billionaire's joint where he and the billionaire figure out how to save money for the entire what Johnston calls the political donor class. In other words, the people that buy influence.
Yes.
And as a upstate New York resident, this guy is actually native to Rochester, New York. And he was a New York Times financial writer for a while, so it had local resonance for me. But irrespective of that, it's a fantastic book, and even a decade beyond its copyright, it is well worth reading for everyone.
Well, for anyone who wants to understand, you know, how we got where we're going and how we got in this handbasket, it's kind of required reading, wouldn't you say?
I think so, absolutely.
And the other component of that, I think, and I mentioned this briefly at the beginning of the program, as sort of a natural progression of the predation of the 1%, is, you know, these comments made by this Perkins creep about how he thinks voting ought to be handled.
Was that in your first hour, Bob?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in and out of the room. So
yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. This cat by the name of Tom Perkins, a venture capitalist talking to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, says that nobody in this country should vote unless they're paying taxes.
Bob?
Votes should be measured by money. In other words, if you have $1 million, you get 1 million votes. He said that.
And isn't that a natural extension of what they've already achieved?
Yes, it is. I mean, for me, it was kind of gratifying to see this story come out, Dan, because it just means that they're finally being honest about their real plan and their real goal for this country. The religious end of the right wing in this country wants a theocracy. The economic end of the right wing wants a straight up just... blood-sodden oligarchy and plutocracy, and they'll find some common ground there where, you know, they'll have a couple of Christianista religious leaders on the one hand, and the right wing will. I mean, you don't if you're measuring votes by money, anything that you and I are going to do at the ballot box is going to be pretty much immaterial.
Let me make one more comment. This, Bob, is what I was referring to last week or 2 weeks ago when I said, once you see it everywhere.
You're absolutely right.
Because it comes at you from all angles. These guys don't rest. I'll step down now.
Okay, go ahead, Jim.
No, just an interesting thing historically. I received something on Facebook yesterday or this morning. From William F. Buckley's nephew, wanted me to be a friend, or something like that. And then, of course, when I clicked on the thing, this huge picture of William F. Buckley clicked up. And I can remember him on Firing Line. Remember that program?
Oh, yes.
When he would sit there with that pad and pencil, and he would just so disparagingly denigrate his opponent.
Yeah,
And my reply to him was, I said, you know, I remember your uncle quite well. He lived in my hometown. As a matter of fact, my grandmother lived next door to him. And when he was a boy, he had a boa constrictor that was like 15 feet long that got loose. And guess where they found that damn snake?
Where?
On my grandmother's porch in the wisteria hanging off the top of it. And she had to call his mother, whom she knew, Eloise, and said, you know, I wish you'd come over and get that goddamn snake. Because it belongs to your son, I've heard about it. But what I went on to say was basically, I remember on firing line back in 68 when I was very young and I saw Gorby Doll and William F. square off. And I said then, the mask really fell from his rather well-doctored eyes and you saw him for what he really was. When he was calling Gorby Doll all kinds of horrible names and stuff like that, and it was just, oh, it was incredible. I have yet to see a reply.
You know, I've seen that. I think that's available. You can watch that on YouTube or some such. And it is. It's kind of shocking.
Well, I think Buckley met his match in that guy.
The sound of Buckley's voice had me reaching for a straight razor, and I wasn't going to shave. I couldn't stand the man.
Well,
he was just a pompous ass. And,
amen.
And his contribution to the American war effort was to teach Spanish. But the thing about it is, the message to me from his nephew was in Spanish. And I simply replied to him, I said, non parlez jamais, pense y toujours. Never speak of it, but think of it always. And I ended it with the word merde, which means shit.
Yes, indeed. Well done. Well done. Well, like I said, this is, I guess, three Fridays in a row that we have talked about this ongoing disaster. And you know, I appreciate the, I appreciate all the input because a lot of the times I just sit around here wanting to scream. But there's more stuff out there. They've been trying to consider this above ground storage tank bill that's been moving through the West Virginia legislature. And this thing is a comedy of errors. Because no one seems able to, and see, remember, this goes kind of hand in glove with the fact that Earl Ray Tomlin consulted with stakeholders before he introduced his version of the bill. And the stakeholders, it turned out, were the West Virginia Coal Association, the West Virginia Oil and Gas Association, the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce, and the other usual suspects. But nobody who was actually, you know, had a dog in the hunt, as we say around here, from having exposed their children to this stuff or having consumed it themselves. No. But what's hilarious about this, nothing is hilarious about this, but this tank bill is more exemption than it is tank. Robert Smith is an attorney for the Judiciary Committee in the House of Delegates, and he said, after you go through all the exceptions, it's really unclear what's left to be regulated by the above-ground storage tank section. So they'll come up with something, but it will do nothing. I mean, you can't beat that stuff for just, you know, straight up, self-satire, self-parody.
So it's a bill straight out of the committee for public information.
They're going to go through the emotions, and the end result will be absolutely nothing.
Precisely. Sound and fury signifying nothing.
That's it, Bob. You know, that's the way it is. They'll trot out their people, and they'll have a big drama about it, and then all of a sudden, the crisis will, as of magic, go away.
Remember when not a scientist, Angela Logo Massini, was opining about how we already had enough laws? You get the idea that they've gotten their message through long before she published anything. There's a passage in this Charleston Daily Mail story where it reads, "The conversation quickly spiraled away from exemptions, heading instead to what types of regulations the DEP had over the Freedom Site.
Boggs and other DEP officials acknowledged the site had a general stormwater permit, but they argued it wasn't enough to allow the DEP to make the specific inspections necessary under the bill. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of these people who are still in the thrall of the industries, well, we've got laws, why didn't you do something about them? But God almighty, the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection exists specifically to protect industries and not people, and certainly not the environment.
Bob, I've got a friend whose husband works for DEP, or whatever you want to call it, and she and I have connected through the animal protection thing that we run, the ARCAR here. And I asked her, I said, and she substitutes regularly in the public schools here, not in the areas that are connected. And I just asked her, I said, given what you, I'm sure you and your husband have had some discussions about what's going on, and I said, would you drink the water out of any fountain around here? And her reply was an emphatic no. Now, if that doesn't tell you something, I don't know what will.
Yeah, and you're not, and of course, you know, you're not even in the affected area.
Well, neither is she, but she told me that she would never drink that water again.
Listen, I landed at Yeager Airport in Charleston. I carried my stuff out to the car. I got in the car. I drove up the mountain. I did not stop until I got home. And that's not to say it's some long drive, but, you know, it used to be that, you know, I'd get off the plane and maybe go somewhere downtown, maybe have a bite of sushi or something like that, you know, just because the flying around process is kind of, I don't know, it just kind of messes with your head a little bit and you just want to decompress. I won't do that anymore. I can't afford to do that anymore. And I'm not talking about financially. I'm talking about I cannot afford to sit there and run the risk of consuming God only knows what. And since I mentioned sushi, I mean, it's not always sushi, but everything is compromised. It's just that in a moment like this, it gets brought home to you and dropped on your doorstep like, you know, like a mouse.
And nobody's going to want to come here as long as, you know, the water is poison or has the potential of poisoning X number of years later. I mean, who's going to want to populate the convention center and the capital of the state? Who's going to want to even go through this state? I mean, who's going to want to do whitewater rafting when the very water in which they're going to be splashed about on is poison? Nobody.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the rivers being poisoned. You know, long before this spill ever took place, and that's the thing that it's hard to get, and it's not hard to get folks in this discussion or in the Horn family commune to understand it. Everybody grasps it pretty easily. But it was 4 years ago when American Rivers put the Gauley River, which is one of the preeminent whitewater rafting rivers in the United States, especially the eastern U.S., it was 4 years ago when, or more perhaps, when American Rivers put it on its list of top 20 endangered rivers in the United States. And it was because of all the filth being dumped into it by mountaintop removal operations upstream. The New River flows north out of North Carolina through Virginia into West Virginia, and it is compromised to one extent or another. And yet people do come and they do, like I've said before, this is a multi-million dollar tourism industry here.
And it'll last for, what, 3 months out of the year?
Well, the Gauley is basically September to the third week in October. The new is paddleable, basically 12 months out of the year, depending on what you want to do. The rafting companies generally start up in March and close in October.
Well, that's going to mean a lot of lost revenue for people who are scared to come here. And believe you me, there are other places where they can go to enjoy their pastimes and their vacation.
But all these years that we've said, listen, ecotourism and tourism generally cannot coexist with the extractive coal industry. No, hell no, that ain't right. No, look here, we're good citizens. Well, the fact of the matter is they're blowing the living hell out of a mountain within a couple of miles as the crow flies, of the New River Gorge National Park.
Oh, yeah, Bob, they're open for business, aren't they?
Yeah, open for business.
And what you just described, Bob, is an expansion of the disaster from the immediate folks, the 300,000, the third of a million folks in those nine affected counties, well beyond that area into the local economy. So it really, its boundaries are expanding like our universe. The disaster grows economically.
Well, to be fair, Dan, that's not entirely correct, because the other disaster, it's not expanding so much as this disaster is found its way into the living rooms of people who have a little more privilege than somebody who has to live underneath a mountaintop removal site. This the larger encompassing disaster has been taking place 10, 15, 20 years now. And that's why, for instance, if you go to ACAC.org,
yep,
and you look at the birth defect study, mm-hmm, they had a data set that I think was 1996 to 2003, 1.5 million live births in Appalachia. And you see, and 1996 is roughly when mountaintop removal gets going in earnest. And you see it, you see basically a line that begins to crawl upward on the, you know, on the graph. And then you hit George Bush's ascension into the presidency, and that thing all of a sudden swings up like a fighter jet, just, you know, climbing straight up.
A force multiplier times 10.
Yeah.
Was mountaintop removal okayed by the Congress, or executive order, or the state?
That requires just a little bit of history. Through the 50s and the 60s, strip mining, as it was known, or as the coal industry likes to call it, surface mining,
yeah,
or contour mining, I mean, you know, it's a contour, got completely out of hand.
You're talking about out west?
No, here. Well, everywhere. But in Appalachia, it was a means whereby the companies could sort of circumvent. Well, it's always about cutting out labor in favor of mechanization and fewer employment costs.
Sure.
So what happens is a great hue and cry arises throughout Appalachia because it was essentially unregulated. And they were going hell bent for leather. And people were saying, this has to stop. And they formed citizens' councils, and they worked tirelessly. This is a generation ago. And they were pushing, by the time Jimmy Carter got into office, they were pushing for an outright ban on the practice. Just, you can't do this. Among other people, the Sierra Club stepped in and negotiated the surface, on behalf of the stupid hillbillies, negotiated the Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act, SMCRA, which Jimmy Carter signed into law reluctantly and said so. He said, "He said this is a bad law, and I don't like it, but I'm going to sign it." And what SMCRA alleged to do was to regulate the practice of strip mining. And what it did also along the way, SMCRA codified the existence of mountaintop removal. And so through the 80s, the coal industry spent more of its time busting the unions, because that's always been of critical importance ever since the union was allowed to exist and protect the rights of workers, and to a certain degree try to protect their health. Periodically, contracts were renegotiated. For instance, one of the most shameful ones, I think it was in the 1950s, when the bituminous coal operators of America reached a collective bargaining agreement with the United Mine Workers of America, in which they agreed not to mechanize as much as they had wanted to so as to protect jobs, but only so long as the UMWA got rid of its Negro members.
Got rid of its black people?
Yeah. Because from its earliest days, the UMWA had been an integrated union because everybody is black down in the hole. But that, you know, that's one moment. But they focused, you know, the late 70s into the 80s and into the early 90s, they focused on destroying union representation. And then by about 1996, they began to ramp up the process of mountaintop removal. And like I said, it goes absolutely bug-eyed crazy the minute George W. Bush comes into office.
Sure, I remember that.
And so what we have now is more than 500 mountains gone, a land mass area equivalent to the state of Delaware no longer exists. Something on the order of 2,000 miles of streams have been buried. Entire mining communities have been eliminated. You can look up, for instance, Twilight, West Virginia. And it has been, and I even saw the other day, I saw a proposal written by a former executive of what was then known as Columbia Natural Gas, in which he made an argument for the outright depopulation of Appalachia to make it more convenient for the coal companies and the gas companies to do their dirty business.
Absolutely incredible.
Well, they're looking out for the health of the health of the residents there, Bob.
Yeah.
Gee, nice of them, wasn't it?
And, right, and of course, as I've mentioned before, I've almost stopped looking in comment sections on blog posts on this story, simply because sooner or later some progressive, some liberal is going to say, why don't them people move?
That's exactly what they want you to do.
Yeah, and I keep thinking, exactly, Jim, and I keep thinking, yeah, because the grapes of wrath worked out so well.
Mm-hmm. You've just described, Bob, an American version of ethnic cleansing.
That's what we've been saying all along.
Yeah.
It is an ethnic cleansing. It is a slow-rolling genocide.
I've been on Google Maps, and before, I don't know, my version went white about a year or so ago, but I had topography up till then, where green was green, the oceans were blue, and everything was pictured as it is, and man, zeroing in, I focused in on Beckley and then expanded out from that, and you can actually see these sites. They are charcoal gray moonscapes, and it is stunning.
Absolutely lunar in their appearance.
Yeah, and you know, we're not kidding. I mean, I try to come up with colorful ways to describe these god awful hellscapes, but one of them is to say that a crow flying across has to pack a lunch.
Yeah.
But it's true, and yeah, really, if you just start flying around central Appalachia, you know, eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, southern West Virginia, southwest Virginia, you just see what look like cancers, like skin, it looks like skin cancer.
Yeah.
On the body of the planet. And they're visible with the relative altitude of something like Google Earth. They're visible from pretty high up.
Sure.
And it's absolutely mind-boggling. If you ever happen to get the chance to fly into Charleston from Atlanta on a clear day, it's like getting a tour of mountaintop removal. You know exactly when you've hit central Appalachia because these great patches of death just start appearing.
Bob, they're simply scars. They're scars for which there is no healing.
Well, I know in Ohio, you know, the guys that were doing mining, when they left, they made big ponds and small lakes that they stocked with fish, and they were pushing how good it was to go down there and go fishing, which I never did, of course. But and then I found out about how they came about having these lakes, you know, and it was that, what were they, what kind of mining did they call that, Bob?
Well, that was, those are either old impoundment ponds or strip mining certainly happened, especially in southeast Ohio.
Yeah, that
you know, from about St. Clairsville south.
That was was a huge shovel down there that they had a big name painted on the side of it.
Yeah, those things are called drag lines.
Yeah, a big drag line they had. Uh-huh. It was one of the biggest ones ever built. You know? Don't stand in the way between those guys and money, that's for damn sure.
No, because they'll kill you.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, they will. And, you know, they will, apparently, if they find someone who is in opposition to their interests and their objectives, they're not above having, well, the use of extreme prejudice employed.
Well, in this memo that was written by this gas company executive, he talks about the fact that some people couldn't move, the old and the infirm, and, of course, the people that the coal company still needed to get it to coal. But he said eventually the only people that are left will be the employees, because the old and infirm will just die off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is a shocking document to behold.
I've seen certain aspects of the health business and such when you get to a certain age that is rather slap me across the face again. Say that one more time, you young shit, and I'll smack you silly is my attitude, you know, because I hear it a lot from these people. I have a bad feeling with some of these alleged social workers and alleged health people and such, you know. No matter what, I'm sitting around here waiting for a medicine delivery because these guys screwed it up. And, you know, you're not supposed to do anything but sit around. Don't worry about anything. Oh, your friends want to go out and have dinner? Well, the hell with you. You know, that kind of stuff. My old piano player dragged my ass to the bank this morning so I could get there. Friends have been really good at times. But, yeah, the bottom line is that, you know, it's like, you know, if somebody stole my abacus, you know, we don't count, is what it comes down to. That's where the whole attitude of the ruling class is. We're right back to Mark Twain again, you know.
Kind of feels that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, the classic Gilded Age. And it's like people who don't know about the great floods that... And the rainstorms that happened, was in the late 20s, and what that effect it had. They seem to be able to doctor up and commercial out the realities of people's everyday living. And, of course, your everyday living with the sound of the land you're standing on being blown out from underneath you, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's what it is.
Hey Bill, I want to say hello to you from Syracuse. I'm a Buffalo native originally, and I enjoy your stories about Cleveland, a city and whose people and sports teams I've long admired. I enjoyed the 64 Browns.
Yeah, the 64 team was to me. I was downtown that night in downtown Cleveland, and they held. You know, that's from the days when they played alternating cities. You didn't have any super anything, you know.
Okay, yep.
And downtown Cleveland was loaded with Baltimore football fans. And
yeah.
I found myself a good seat and watched these drunks fight. It was pretty fun. It was free boxing, you know.
I always wondered back then, Bill, what the 64 Bills would have done against the 64 Browns.
Yeah, that was the whole, you know, that's the second time that and TV actually allowed the American Football League to exist and get stronger.
To survive, absolutely.
Yeah, survive, because that's what the All-American Football Conference of the 40s, the only teams that came into the NFL were the Browns, the 49ers, and I believe a team in Texas that failed and moved to Baltimore.
I thought the Colts were involved in that, too. But isn't that, even back then, Bill, 50, 60 years ago, an example of a monopoly being busted?
Absolutely.
By people that were locked out and wanted to be a part of the opportunity to be prosperous.
Well, for those
Ralph
of you...
Wilson paid $25,000 for the Buffalo Bills franchise, as did all the other AFL guys that created that league, nine of them, I think. Yeah. And then they, once the Giants signed the Buffalo Bills kicker, the game was on, and it forced the merger, the common draft and all, and we see it today, the result today. But, you know, the NFL was a closed boys' club. It was a country club.
Well, no
uninvited guests allowed.
I have to go now.
Well, all right, take care, Jim.
Hey, you have a good evening and a good weekend. Happy Valentine's Day to all.
Take care, Jim.
You as well. Bye now, Jim.
When they had that merger between the All-America Conference teams, Paul Brown and George Halas just went for each other's throats. Mm. They played a game in 51 or 52, if anybody could look it up and find the stats. Those two teams set a record for many years for personal fouls. Oh, these two teams went at each other like... And Halas, of course, what, in 57, he put a price on the head of Bobby Lane, who was Detroit quarterback, and he got caught doing it. Uh-huh. Very similar to what New Orleans people did.
Yeah, well, and, you know, they'll game the system, these guys, right?
Yep.
How about Belichick in New England? But I think that to some degree, there's always competitors seek an edge.
Well, this is what we're talking about, business. If somebody will do this with a business like professional football and they'll game the system, what the hell do you think they're going to do with the big industrial and other and financial and
absolutely
things that are so goddamn much money, I can't count that high.
And that even more importantly, Bill, have such an impact on our lives. I say often that I am interested in politics and history and economics because, goddamn it, they affect our lives.
Sure.
I'm not a glutton for punishment.
Well, I'm working a book right now about some fighting that went on in World War One in the Balkans. And
are you talking about that book that you refer to?
The Gardens of Salonika.
Yeah. When you follow these allies and these central powers just trying to maneuver mm-hmm. to get other human beings to go out and kill each other.
Yeah.
It's after a while, you keep saying, well, Bill, get that shovel, dig the hole, and jump into it.
You know, that's why I love that one line that John Sayles puts in the mouth of the organizer in the movie Mate One when he's trying to explain why he was a conscientious objector during the First World War. And, of course, he was sent to Leavenworth and, you know, within the arc of the movie, he was treated like hell because people were treated like hell for being a conscientious objector. But he has the character say at one point by way of explanation, all I saw was workers killing workers.
Yeah.
And that's all that boiled down to.
It comes down to the working people picking up their rifles and the upper class is telling them who to aim it at, you know? Amen.
Jay Gould.
Yeah, I can get half the working class to kill the other half.
Yeah.
A few years ago, when Scott Walker was pulling his bullshit in Wisconsin, a neighbor of mine was walking his dogs down the sidewalk, and I was particularly outraged that morning, and I just unloaded on this guy. I thought, in sympathy with him, and he puked his bullshit all over me about how his mother got screwed out of a good pension and how he didn't get a raise last year and why should these people get anything. And I thought, God damn it, this is what I read about.
Well, look
this
at the,
what,
look
this
at this
is what
look,
I hear about.
Look at this Volkswagen business in Tennessee.
Yeah.
I know.
I mean, that's absolutely mind-blowing, the fact that a sitting U.S. senator would come out and say something that was absolute, just made-up crap. You know, Volkswagen wants the UAW in its plant. Volkswagen has made no bones about it.
We have them in Europe, that's for damn sure.
And the reason they want the union in the plant is they want to set up a European-style plant in the United States with that workers' council that is mandated, for instance, by German law.
Sure. That we insisted on.
Yeah, when we imposed our will during the Reconstruction of Europe. But actually, they predated it because those workers' councils existed in manufacturing plants during the Weimar Reconstruction. Just as it was the case that in order to keep the 1%'s heads attached to their shoulders, Bismarck, who was no lefty, took the steps necessary to introduce old age pensions and workers' compensation inside the unified Germany in the late 19th century.
But Bismarck looks like a humanist,
right? Yeah, you know that the right wing is just completely over the cliff. So here you go. The Volkswagen wants the union, and a sitting U.S. senator takes it upon himself to declare that unless the union is rejected, Volkswagen will not. Well, that he's heard.
He's heard. Yes.
That if the union is rejected, that he's almost certain that Volkswagen will build its new midsize SUV at that Chattanooga plant. I mean, it's stunning.
Scare the fools.
And in true Jay Gould fashion, yeah, they've been able to gin up a group who, I don't want no union. Well, okay, fine. Quit.
Yeah. Right. Bob, I could never understand that, especially, I felt a certain degree of, being a northern guy, I felt different. I saw what unions did in the city. Cleveland at one time was the fifth biggest city in the country, 33 councilmen, and they were mostly, every neighborhood was a different ethnicity, and the councilman better have the same lineage as the people he represented or she. So, they brought a lot of that European, we got a subversive squad here, as far back as the 20s. Because of the European immigrants bringing stuff with them from the old country. Bringing intrigue or, anger from one area of Europe against another or whatever, Human nature, it devastates me.
Well, sometimes it can be pretty devastating.
Yeah. I think that people that vote Republican are not necessarily not voting their interests. It's which interests are preeminent when they walk into that voting booth. Economic interests, social interests, their Second Amendment interests, they all vie for the top rung. And I think it's not quite accurate to say that they're not voting their interests. But I think they're, in this country where the attention span is shockingly short, those interests, those self-interests, can be swayed one way or the other, and it's discouraging because I've long held a theory that when money matters are not a stressor in your life, that those other issues melt away. They really just kind of disappear.
Well, the religious folks can become a marching army for the wealthy.
Oh, absolutely.
Because after all, your reward isn't here on earth. It's in the hereafter. What's your hereafter?
Right.
Whereas us union folks are marching for the workers.
Yep. Right now.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think in a lot of cases it's...
Oh.
We have Skypers.
Sorry.
Yes. Sergi, and then Tracy.
Okay. All right. Well, first off, hey, everyone. I don't think I've said hey yet.
Hey, Sergi.
I think in a lot of cases, it's people, it's not necessarily not in their self-interest. It's that they have their priorities screwed up. I have met quite a few people around here, Fort Worth, Dallas, and then rest of North Texas. They are single issue voters, and it's not a really important single issue like jobs.
No, they're voting.
The
they're voting over the precious little fetuses.
That was precisely what I'm getting to. Yeah, I have met so many people who say, well, I would vote Democratic. I agree with them on economic issues, but I have to vote against abortion. And I look at them and I'm just like, I always ask them some kind of variant on this one question. So you mean to tell me you would be willing to see the entire economy sink? You'd be willing to see the planet poisoned, but God forbid some fetuses.
The thing you're dealing with there, Sergi, is that there's a rational disconnect at work. Because, see, they believe in the invisible juvenile delinquent with the beard in the sky. And consequently, they have been told from the pulpit time after time after time after time after time that if they just protect the little fetuses, that God will bless America, and even if the economy burns down to the ground, God will give us a new one for them little fetuses to grow up in a Christian family. And see, they believe that craziness. And so you can't make any way with them by arguing with their brains. The fact of the matter is, the more accessible reproductive health care is, whether it be contraception or abortion, the more accessible it is, and the more you provide opportunities for economic advancement for women, the lower the abortion numbers go. But again, that is a rational argument being presented to irrational people. Tracy, you had something.
Well, this, you know, like you got saying about the crazy people who, you know, help me be a Christian, and I'm, you know me, I'm all for, so, you know, using the hereafter as a catch-all. I mean, they did it with the slaves. It's like, okay, you know what, y'all? It's going to be all right. You know, yes, we could beat you and starve you and rape you and do everything, you know, like I would say before, that would be considered crimes against humanity to this day, but you're going to get your reward in heaven, so that's okay. Everything will be all right. So sometimes I just can't breathe when I hear some of the stuff that, you know.
Oh, sometimes I hoot like a barn owl.
And then you get the other people, I mean, along with, you know, praying for the fetuses, you want to pray against the black Muslim in the right house. Because you know he's a Muslim and an atheist.
With a deep-seated hatred of white people, absolutely.
With a deep-seated hatred of white folk. And it's like, no. His mama was white. Y'all, don't you keep forgetting that there is a he was raised by white folk. Hell, he's more white than a lot of white people that I know. I'm just saying. What's that mean? I mean.
Yeah. No. No.
I mean. It's just, you know.
Wait a minute.
I'm just so tired. Huh?
Are you really trying to give my Kenyan Muslim socialist a free pass? Because if he really was a Kenyan Muslim socialist, I'd love him a lot more.
Yes, I would love him a lot more. I mean, I went to text Bob this morning. I was watching the news. You know, we're going through a really horrible drought out here in California. And, you know, he's coming all out here to talk out the drought. And I'm like, well, okay, welcome to California, but what about West Virginia?
West for who?
And then I thought about it. Wait, there's more votes in California than in West Virginia for Democrats.
There's no. He doesn't have. He's not running for anything ever again, Tracy. There's more money.
Money, yes. Well, that's. I mean, votes equate to money to me. So it's like I'm going, oh, see, that's the deal. Because I'm sitting there going, okay, you can't make it rain. I mean, unless you are a rainmaker, we don't know about it. So why the hell are you in California? And not in West Virginia, or having somebody go. I mean, okay, like you said, we don't need to see you in West Virginia, you know, president, not so sure. But what about, you know, sending somebody, I don't know, FEMA, some people out there to clean up the water? Just little things like that. I am befuddled.
And you've got a right. You've got a right to be.
And I don't even live in West Virginia, but I have friends that do. And again, what happens in West Virginia, just because it happened there doesn't mean it can't happen anywhere else.
No. Tracy, it's not even can, it's will.
It will happen somewhere
else. It's kind of like the sludge dams. It's not if they break and if the toxic waste gets loose and roars down the holler. It's when it breaks loose.
You know, it's like when they closed down the nuclear power plant out here in was it San Ysidro? I call it the the building of the breast because it looked like
San Onofre.
San Onofre, yes. Where it looks, it looks breastises.
Doesn't one of them like wine?
Yeah. Or like when my well water that feeds the building I live in was contaminated with E. coli, and I didn't even know it until like a week later when I read a notice on the frickin' front door to the damn apartment complex.
Well, it's like when in back last
never did figure out why I was so sick.
Well, like the in December or so or November when they had an outbreak of something at the Rio Hotel, and they hadn't even notified their guests. They heard about it. The people heard about it that were staying at the hotel on the news.
Well, the same thing happened with the mayor of the little town of Chesapeake, West Virginia, a few days ago, when the fine folks at Patriot Coal dumped 100,000 gallons of poison into the creek and the river. And he said, well, they didn't tell me. And, you know, he's just downstream from this thing. They didn't tell me. I learned about it in the newspaper. And so, and remember, they are supposed to, these spills are supposed to be reported immediately. But our buddy Angela Langostino, or whatever her name is, she says it's a failure of the emergency preparedness. Well, how can emergency preparedness work if nobody tells anybody anything? You know, Freedom Industries never called in the dump of this poison in Charleston until they were compelled to after the fact. So, you know, how can you take proactive measures if the coal company's waiting 2 hours to call it in? If the Freedom Industries boys are you know, just refuse to call it in? How are you supposed to have emergency response? But then once you've been notified and you sit on your hands for 5 hours while people are drinking and bathing and et cetera, then that becomes a problem for the likes of Earl Ray Tomlin. Had somebody ready to come on, and I guess I lost him. Dang it. But that's, you know, I don't know how you regulate somebody who refuses to be regulated, because that's what all this is. It's a refusal to be regulated, and yet this idiot woman in Washington D.C. says that we just lack perspective here.
No, wait a minute. They don't refuse to be regulated. They have paid to not be regulated.
Well, there's no small amount of truth in that, too, Jay Cruz. Oh, by the way, I had something Ron and Raleigh wanted to toss out to the group for consideration. He said, the Michael Dunn case has gone into its second day of deliberations in Florida. How in the hell does it take more than 2 days to decide that a man that fires 10 shots into an SUV is guilty of at least second-degree murder? Ron says, he's going to get off.
No,
that
shit.
That was because he was defending his right to not hear other people's music?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah. Because they scared him.
Yeah, it was self-defense of his eardrums.
Right.
Well, like I said, had he not had a gun, he wouldn't have rolled up on the brothers. I believe you me.
No, he would. See, I'm firmly convinced dude was going hunting. Only he was hunting humans.
No, he was coon hunting. Bob, go ahead and.
No. I would never, Tracy.
No, I can say it. He was coon hunting. There, I said it.
And I think there's an element. I think there's an element of truth to it.
I mean, you know, he figured, well, George Zimmerman got off. You know, why not shoot me a couple of? You know,
Well, you remember what got the Grease Man kicked off DC radio back in the day when the MLK holiday was first coming online.
Oh no.
I think it was the Grease Man.
I don't even know who the Grease Man is.
Okay,
so
the Grease Man was this professionally outraged, this guy who was paid to be outrageous and say mean, hurtful, spiteful, nasty things on the radio at a radio station called DC 101 in Washington, D.C. When the Air Florida crash happened a few years ago after takeoff from a National Airport, I think he was the one who called the ticket counter to ask how much a one-way ticket to the 14th Street Bridge was, or whatever the bridge it was that it hit.
God.
And so I think it was also the Grease Man. I could be wrong. If I'm wrong, somebody correct me. But who said of the Martin Luther King Day holiday, shoot six more and we get the week off.
Christ. Yeah, that's perfect.
So, you know, let's just understand the burbling lava magma toxic cell that just sort of waits under the, and that's what it is. These little moments are just little volcanoes of putrescence that come up into the culture periodically because the culture can no longer restrain, the thin crust of the culture can no longer restrain the violent vitriolic force of the hatred. I mean, I've got a clip here. I was going to save it till Wednesday, but why? It's a clip from back in 2013 that is only just now seeing the light of day. It is the, why am I not surprised with his last name? It's a preacher named Brother Donnie Reagan. And Donnie Reagan is the pastor of Happy Valley Church of Jesus Christ. Okay? And he's all upset about biracial babies. Let's just take a moment. Stand by.
Now, I'm going to deal with something for just a few minutes. It's probably going to make some folks mad, but what's new? Now, we realize that there's a move in the message of blacks marrying whites, whites marrying blacks. It's okay. I excuse y'all from saying amen. I wouldn't want you to be committed where anybody would know that y'all stood for the truth. And folks think it's all right. But you know what? My God still has nationalities outside the city. Now watch this. Brother Bram says, hybriding, hybriding. How terrible hybriding. The hybrid, the people. It's a big molding pot. I got hundreds of precious colored friends that's born again Christians. But on this line of segregation and things that they're talking about, hybriding the people. What? Tell me what a fine cultured, fine Christian colored woman would want her baby to be a mulatto by a white man. No, sir. It's not right. Now, I realize I got sent a forum thing not long ago for some folks that was doing a forum in the message, and they're talking about how racial Brother Branham was. Now, they supposedly believe Brother Branham was a prophet and follow his message, but they're like a bunch of others. They nitpick, you know, it's a buffet to them. This ain't a Shoney's breakfast buffet, 11 o'clock on Friday night. Amen. Well, glory. Even the preachers are getting quiet on me now. Now, remember, Brother Branham, as he's looking at this, and in this form that I was reading about these preachers and other people that was writing, I said, well, Brother Branham said that because that he was a Southerner. And Brother Branham was saying that because it was in the 60s, and that's when all the racial stuff was going on. So that's why Brother Branham was saying, well, that was Brother Branham's opinion. That's always a good cop-out whenever you don't agree with him. That's just his opinion. Well, maybe I'm ignorant and dumb, but when it comes right down to it, I'll take his opinion over mine. So I guess you know that's where it puts yours. Now watch, he says, it's not right. Now friends, I'm not very smart, but how much do we have to explain when something is not right? What white woman would want her baby to be a mulatto by a colored man? God made us what we are. Let's stay the way God made us. I believe it's right.
We're going to stop right there because this goes on for 17 minutes.
Wow.
The Happy Valley Church of Jesus Christ is located, anybody want to guess?
Tennessee?
You win.
Seriously?
Johnson City, Tennessee, Stan.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm happy to meet them.
I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Do they have an email address where I can send them pictures of my kids just to friggin' rub it in their face?
Sadly, no. But I don't think it'd be any help, Jay Cruzen, because he said, if God wanted a man brown, black, white, whatever color he wanted him, that's God's creation. That's the way he wanted it. So, you know, the creationists need to understand that they're on the same side of the debate with this guy. Because, see, everybody was created one color, and it's only because of sin that we've got gradations.
Well, what, you know, one thing you can blame your hatred on, you can blame it on an invisible man in the sky, you know. That way you don't have to take the heat for it.
And Marty wants to know, is this a black preacher by any chance? No, no, this is white folks. And like I said, every now and then you get these little volcanoes. These little volcanoes of just bigotry that erupt through the very, very thin veneer of civility, what little of it is left in this country. And just remember, this guy's hate, this guy's bigotry, this guy's racism, this guy's prejudice, this guy's ignorance is protected by the First Amendment? And this guy, not only having his hate and his bigotry protected by the First Amendment, has a right to go out and protect that freedom with a gun. For Jesus' sakes.
Well, when I carried for many years, the only thing I was trying to protect was my fat ass, you know?
Yeah.
That was traveling from places where people were staggering so bad, they didn't know what day it was, and you never know with one of those guys what the hell they'd want to do. And being 5'6", you know, what the hell am I going to do?
Right, sure.
I'll be damned if I'm going to let one of them kill me, you know. Hey, I have that, that's my aspect of old-time religion. If I have one, that's it. You know, if I was holding the guy up or threatening him over nothing, then I can understand why he would react violently toward me. But I didn't like these guys that get thrown out of the bar. They want to fight with the next idiot out of the bar. Well, here I come. You know, finish working and want to go home. And wrong place, wrong time.
Howdy.
We had two guys get into a big fight in the line to see Santa Claus. And one guy stabbed the other guy to death.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
You said something about Dennis Kucinich, and Dennis was mayor at the time, and he commented on it, of course, vehemently, because there's nothing more violent than standing in line waiting to see Santa Claus.
That brings out the homicidal rage in me, Bill.
I'll tell you.
Hey, Larry, you were going to say something? I heard your voice.
Yeah. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Larry.
I'm late today. I just went out and bought John Lewis's March. It's the graphic novel. I think it's the first one of two. And then there's another one that I just saw that's by Mark Long that's called The Silence of Our Friends, which is a semi-autobiographical novel of the civil rights movement and how a poor white family and a African-American family around Houston around that time found ways to become allies during the civil rights movement. But I can't be sure about that one. But I'm told that the John Lewis graphic novel is really good, and I'm also told not to presuppose that because it's a graphic novel format that it's any less sophisticated than a different kind of a literary format. Okay.
Is that John Lewis, the congressman?
That's correct, yes. Okay. I just got it just now, and it's called March.
Uh-huh.
And once I took, when I got involved in politics, I used a computer program, and I wanted to see how my views on various legislation would stack up with some of the other congresspeople, and I seem to agree with John Lewis 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. So John Lewis and I, back at least in the 90s, were really, really, really close in our political points of view. So I don't know if that tells
you
very
That's pretty good company to be in, Larry.
Okay. I'm glad. Thank you.
Yeah. And let me just here, it's coming up on about 8:30 here on the East Coast. Let me point out that we are, thank you very much this evening to Sal and to Thomas and to Gene. We are at $105 from meeting our fundraising goal for the evening. So with the remaining 31 minutes and change, that's where we need to wind up so we don't start Monday in a hole. That having been said, I should also note that in the remaining half hour of the program, there are two telephone lines open and room open on, in the Skype group. We were talking about the Volkswagen thing a couple of minutes ago, and I found it interesting that, lo and behold, in a closed-door meeting that somehow some comments got out of, President Obama managed to offer some comments on what's going on down in Chattanooga. First of all, the senator, and this is not Obama, but the senator who said that he was just sure if they rejected the UAW that they'd get that new manufacturing plant for that new Volkswagen SUV. The Volkswagen folks spoke expressly to that issue and said, no, nobody said that. And Senator Corker came back and said, well, what I said was true and factual. But meanwhile, Frank Fisher, who is the chief executive of VW Chattanooga, said there is absolutely no connection between the vote on unionization and whether or not Volkswagen builds that vehicle in Chattanooga or Mexico. But meanwhile, speaking to some folks in Maryland, it was a closed-door meeting of Democratic lawmakers in Maryland, according to this Reuters story. And President Obama said that down in Tennessee, local politicians who are more concerned about German shareholders than they are about American workers are the ones driving this controversy. And I went looking around, and I guess the voting closes tomorrow or maybe today, but I haven't seen anything in the way of results.
It's already over with Bob. It was at 8:30.
Okay.
In time it ended.
So it just now ended.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have any results.
No, and you won't till the NLRB counts the votes.
Okay.
This will be interesting.
The NLRB, which is half staffed at this point in time because they couldn't get the president's appointments through, right?
I thought they got some of them through.
Well, did they get them through in time? I don't know. That's worth checking out. But what I also found interesting out of this story is, guess how the workers are voting.
Did they get them through in time?
Not on Diebold equipment.
Yeah, they're not doing any video game voting. All of these votes are being tallied on paper ballots.
Paper.
Go figure.
Why are they going back to paper?
They never used a machine before.
Yeah, well, I know.
Always a paper ballot vote.
I just couldn't.
My union contract.
I couldn't help but note the novelty of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, every vote in the union is on a paper ballot.
I was being sarcastic.
My union, I can't vote anymore because I'm retired. But my union, they always mail out a ballot, and then you mail it back in.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, you know, what's really at stake here is the fact that there's all kinds of European and Japanese auto manufacturers all over the South now. And if the UAW can get a foothold in the Volkswagen plant, well, the Volkswagen plant, in turn, would be more than happy to see the UAW get into Hyundai and Toyota and
BMW and Mercedes.
BMW, Mercedes, Kia. Right, exactly.
Yep.
And the thing about the story is the workers went to the UAW, not the UAW trying sticking their nose in the tent.
Right, and the Volkswagen management is supportive because their governing council in Germany has a significant union presence, which has oddly enough helped make very, very nice livings for the people who work for Volkswagen because they're represented.
And, you know, Bob, there is some certain self-interest among management in a union shop. I come from the very tightly regulated telephone communications realm, and top craft pay determined management's pay above that. So that if a guy working outside, for example, as a installer and repairman made $1,000 a week, his boss made more than that. So these guys, now the executive suites and the boardrooms are, you know, they're in their own stratosphere. But everybody that was close to craft people, unionized people, blue-collar types, understood that if the union went away, their pay drops. Or if the union jobs go away, their job might go away as well. And I had a difficult time explaining that to a neighbor of mine, the wife of a guy I used to work with who took a management job. I'm retired now, but when I was working, he took a management job. First level is the immediate supervisor, and then his boss is second level, and on up, 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 up. And so this guy, who will probably never arise above first level management, his pay grade is determined by the contract that determines the pay among the people that he supervises. His wife has a hard time understanding that the union is good for them, even though her husband walked away from the union, the blue collar, and put on a white collar 8 or 10 years ago. This is the disconnect that these people suffer from.
Can I say something about that?
Jump right in.
Hey, Tracy.
I have a friend that's management, and her job is to, you know, not so much bus unions, but she went on a rant the other day. We have, like, kind of like how we have the front porch. It's me and a couple of my friends, and every day we just go on about our day and, you know, in messages. And so they were having some kind of, I guess, when the union comes in to make sure everything is the way it's supposed to be. And she works in a hospital, and she was going, I cannot stand unions, blah, 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 blah. And you know me, troublemaker. So I said, what's the problem with unions? And she's like, well, you know, they this and this and that. I said, well, you know, coming from somebody that used to be in the union, I used to be in UFCW Local 770 back when I was the cashier at Rouse. And my father was in the Carpenter Union for years. That's how I got my braces and pretty damn good medical care and all that. I said, well, coming from, you know, a union family, this is how my take on unions. I said, if unions were the great equalizer, like, you know, you were saying, I said, it didn't matter what color you were, what gender you were, or what have you. If I got paid, if my homeboy got paid, you know, $15 an hour, that I got paid $15 an hour as long as I was doing the same job. I said, if it wasn't for the unions, there would be no, you know, OSHA, you know, there would be no.
Well, there'd be no 40-hour work week. There'd be no weekend. There would be no workers' compensation.
Overtime pay.
Yeah.
Have 8-hour work before work week. There would be no weekend. There would be no overtime pay. And bottom line is that we, you know, if it wasn't the unions pay black folks, and so I, you know, because when it's about race, they get quiet. I said, and if it wasn't for unions, my grandmother and my dad and would not have had a decent. I said, unions were the great equalizer, and until and when unions were, you know, 30 to 40% of the working people in this country unionized, we had a good amount for unions, 87%.
You're breaking up some, Tracy.
Our economy. Am I breaking up again?
Yeah, you do. Well, but so we see the significance of something like the UAW being able to get into the plant in Chattanooga, because that opens up the possibility of decent lives because the money is not all that good at these Mercedes and BMW plants and Hyundai and Kia and what have you. It's not that great.
No.
Well, aren't most of those states are right to work states?
Absolutely.
On top of that, so if they get you, if somebody gets pissed off at you, they could just fire you for whatever.
Sure.
Think about the potential impact, though, of a union establishing itself, a large national union, the UAW, establishing itself in a right-to-work state, and then people around that area and then spreading out observe the benefits that those union members are going to accrue to themselves by their representation. And even beyond the represented workers themselves, union wages tend to pull up everyone else around them that do not have representation.
Hell yeah. Well, I mean, it's like when the GM yeah. plant in Van Nuys, when that closed, my God.
And another thing to think of.
Go ahead.
Tracy,
you're breaking up. Too bad to hear.
Yeah.
I'll try. I'm hanging up and calling back.
Another thing to think of is that Chattanooga will establish their own local in the UAW, and they will elect their own officers and all that. And they'll probably have their own union hall. That's another thing that pisses off Republicans, because they know the workers are going to get indoctrinated, so to speak, when they go to union meetings.
Yeah, because the company can't be there to intimidate the workers. Sparky, if you can answer this question, or anybody for that matter, what impact does the right to work state have on the fact that a union organizes?
Oh, I don't know, because California is not a right-to-work state.
Well, neither is West Virginia.
I want to see this vote come out pro-union just to see the right wing's heads just collectively go boom.
Well, but the other side of this coin, if I remember some of the things that Boss Man Wayne taught me along the way, is that once the union's organized, if the company didn't want the union, all they'd have to do is sort of drag their feet for a year, and then claim that the vote didn't express the will of the employees. But you don't get the sense that Volkswagen's going to do that.
Well, I am in a right to work state, Florida, and I'm in a union, the IBEW. It makes organizing a lot harder, Bob, but as far as what you just said, once it's recognized by the NLRB, and all they have to do is get a 50% plus one vote to get the union in, according to the NLRB, then after that, either the company has a choice. They have to recognize the union. They can refuse the union, at which point all the union members can just say, okay, bye, and then they don't have a workforce anymore. That's pretty much it, and you know, all the legal shit that involves.
If they vote for the union, though, does that mean people can continue to work there without being a member of the union because it's right to work?
Correct.
Yes, anywhere you are in this country, Bob, you can be part of a union shop, not be a union member, but be a fee payer or a dues payer. You have to pay your dues, not in a right-to-work state, but in a non-right-to-work state. And you pay your dues, you accrue the benefits,
But you're not a representative. If you have an issue, they have to represent you, but you're not officially a union member.
Except for the part you said about dues. They can take the administrative fees for the union, but they cannot take your dues in a right-to-work state.
Yeah, I was speaking of New York and other states like us up here.
In a right-to-work state, they cannot take your dues from your paycheck if you do not want to be in the union. But, but the union still has to represent you.
So you get the benefit and you, of the
and
union,
get,
union.
And you
get...
Exactly.
Yeah, they call free riders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 I have a related question, but not exactly on the topic. I wanted to know about unions. How do they determine who gets what part of the union, where part of the union dues goes, how much of it actually goes to represent, how much of it goes to protect the or it translates into money for the rank and file, and how much of it translates into money for the management, the people who do all the management stuff and do all the lobbying and the...
That's all up to the elected officials of the union.
Okay,
yeah,
so...
Like the IBEW, we have an executive board that has to okay the bill payments and sees where the money goes.
You have your executive boards and you have your own international constitution, which lay out the groundwork for expenditures.
Mm-hmm. So if the rank and
local union.
Oh, thank you, Gary. If the rank and file don't like what's going on, or if they don't feel that they have enough information to go on, or don't trust their leadership, then
they can vote them out.
Response.
Vote them out.
No. Okay. Thank you.
When you pay your dues as a union member, you establish. And there is thereby an establishment of fiduciary responsibility. By payment of your dues, you're effectively hiring representation. So it's a first step grievance, second step grievance, arbitration in that order.
Taxes.
Yeah,
yeah, but we don't have representation.
That's right.
So does anybody have any idea how long it will take to for the NLRB to count the votes? I mean, they say there's about 1,500 workers.
It won't take that long. It'll probably have next week.
It should take a whole lot less than that, unless they're going to carry the ballots to Washington, D.C.
Well, seeing as how today's Friday, you'll probably get the results Monday.
But Monday's a holiday.
Yeah, Monday's a federal holiday.
Okay.
So it'll be Tuesday or something.
Okay.
They should have the votes counted. They should start counting the vote immediately after the polls close.
And they said that, like, out of that 1,500, 1,000 votes were cast, I think, on the first day. And that plant is shut down every Friday for maintenance, and they expected the maintenance workers to do their voting today.
Yeah, well, good on them.
You're right, Gary. I mean, they're going to count them as soon as the polling closes, but... We'll probably get an unofficial result, but you won't get NLRB recognition for a few days after. So,
I would think that they might have an observer from NLRB there, the team, the counting team, wherever the ballots are. I can't imagine.
Yeah, they take the ballots.
Well, I can't. Yeah. I mean, granted, the guy's a senator and everything, but I can't. Goodness gracious, is this? I mean, how is that pronouncement about? Well, we'll only get the manufacturer. We'll only get to build this car if the union's rejected. How is that okay?
It's not, Bob. Well, but this guy's one of 100.
Senators tell lies all the time.
I know, but that wasn't said on the floor of the Senate. I guess what I'm asking is, how is that not a chargeable offense?
Bob, it probably could be under some of the regulations governing conduct of elections under the Department of Labor regulations. That, he would be an outside an outside entity interfering.
I mean, that with, pronouncements like
he's
that.
He's making a campaign statement. Is what he's essentially what he's doing is he's campaigning for the rejection of the union.
Right.
Okay, and he's not allowed to do that under federal regulation.
Well, that's kind of scary because it's damn hard to charge a senator with anything as far as what they say.
Well, I don't give a shit what he is. He's interfering with a goddamn election.
Well, right? I agree.
I mean, I don't give a crap if he's a senator.
I agree, but good luck charging him with anything.
Oh, my God. I don't give a shit.
But, no, I don't.
Jason?
So is that something that a U.S. attorney would have to pursue, Gary?
No, absolutely not. No, the UAW could actually file against him. In my opinion,
an unfair labor practice.
No, a violation of regulation.
Okay.
Jason,
it still hits the U.S. attorney's office either way.
Jason, this is a short, we're talking about this particular election. My question is, what is it going to take for the society to move in the direction of a worker-directed, worker-directed enterprises or worker cooperatives in this country? What is it going to take, and when can we get there?
Well, I mean, if I could just jump in, I know, the question was not directed toward me. But specifically, part of the reason that Volkswagen is not hostile to this UAW organizing attempt is because one of those worker councils would be set up as a result of the UAW being there, and okay. If you recall, Dr. Bill talked about that extensively several months ago within the context of the whole Gemeinschaft versus Gesellschaft theory. And I mean and it would be a big deal because that worker council would operate essentially on the same kind of model that the councils operate on in Germany.
And Gary, I'm not saying I don't agree with you as far as that being a violation. You know, that's kind of like Walmart coming in and saying, you know, if you vote in this union, then they're going to cost you all your jobs or whatever. You know, all the stupid scare tactics. There's a lot of things that people have actually come under fire for, and there are lawsuits working their way through the courts on this anti-union bullshit. As far as him being a U.S. senator and saying it and doing it, I do think it's going to have to hit the U.S. attorney's office.
Well, it would go under the Department of Labor there, because it's a violation.
Yeah, well,
of
the Department of Labor needs to file on behalf of UAW. The UAW makes a complaint to the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor makes a complaint to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Not necessarily within a regulatory framework.
Well, there's still an arbitration process there, but either way, they would have a right to contest the election. You know, let's say they lost by 3 votes. You know what I mean? And UAW could contest the election, but no matter what the election result, it's still a violation of election rules established by the Department of Labor for unions.
Yeah, but Gary, the Department of Labor doesn't get involved until you have a union established.
No, that's not true.
No, the Department of Labor can respond to complaints of unfair labor practices act, like campaigning against an organizing effort.
You have UAW is involved here. They're you know, the vote is on their behalf.
My only point is once you become unionized, you open the Department of Labor to look at everything you got, your books, your meeting minutes, everything.
Yeah, from an anti-corruption standpoint, right, Sparky?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you got to fill out reports. It's called LM2 report every year.
Yeah, that's a bunch of bullshit they laid on us.
When we had our own local in Reading, I was president of the local, so I was involved with all this stuff, besides being an organizer for 3 years.
I was an elected auditor for 9 years, I guess.
Well, I worked my way up through the e-board, held every other office, you know, like... recording secretary and vice president, and I was president, so I was the last president of Local 442, Redding, California.
And then you guys got absorbed?
We got merged with Sacramento.
Well, that's good for you, Donko. About as far as I've been has been a job steward.
But luckily, they couldn't do anything with our pension plan, so I still have a pension. Whereas Sacramento, they just got a defined contribution plan, where you got a pot of money, and then when it's gone, it's gone. But I get the same payment every month now.
Yeah. The American workforce, I don't think I really don't believe that they understand the difference between a defined benefit and a defined contribution. And I reserve the right to speak about that in a week or two, because I have a few strong opinions about those two benefit plans. But it's been a real boon to corporations to avoid that defined benefit, and I, as a represented worker for nearly 30 years in the telecommunications industry, I actually enjoyed both. I walked away with I didn't quite serve 30 years, but I walked away with a pension, took my lump sum, and it walked away with 401k contribution money. So if you want to look at, I've told the people that I used to work with and retired with that, in effect, the CWA negotiated two pensions for me, along with retiree health care benefits. And I believe that every American worker, every worker worldwide, in fact, should have these benefits. And when I hear stories,
they're life changing, aren't they, Dan?
Absolutely. I don't have to worry about the things that I hear discussed on your program and elsewhere. And it is a great absence of stress. I can stress about other things, but not that stuff. And I can
send money to Bob.
And it, absolutely. And so when I point these facts out, I know people that tell me, well, I've got $10,000 saved up. And I said, really? $10,000? Wow. I don't have the heart to crash them in the head with reality. That's hard. And I am dumbfounded by... This is what I was remarking about earlier. When you vote your financial interests, a lot of that other stuff melts away. And I have the ability or the option to concentrate on other important matters, like, damn it, our nation, things that affect. Everyone, not just me personally, in my daily little struggle here, there's almost a point of embarrassment because.
But we don't have the common sense to.
That I have this benefit and everybody else doesn't.
Yeah. And you know what? Maybe that's for next Friday on the front porch. This needs to be an expanded discussion.
Sure.
About how, you know, and because messaging is such an abject failure on the progressive side.
It is.
Maybe we need to, if I can tear myself away from this rolling damn disaster here, maybe that needs to be a central focus. In the meantime, though, we got to get the heck out of here. Thanks, yeah. Everybody. Thank you, Dan.
Great.
Thank you, Bill.
Good night.
Thank you, Sparky, as ever. Thank you, Grant, for joining in. Jay Cruzen, thank you. Sergi, Devin, Sentient, Waggy, Gary, and Larry. Thanks, one and all. You guys make these 3 hours on Friday absolutely fly by. And, of course, the Horn Malloy Skype chat group will be in rare form at about 12:05 a.m. Immediately following the close of the Malloy program as well. So y'all be well. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm going to close things off here. And I'll note, thanks go out to Henry, because Henry just took us down to only $55 to go to finish the week in the good. Thank you very much. It's so nice to be able to start a week fresh and not in a hole. Thank you very much to Henry and to Sal. Thank you to Thomas. Thank you to Gene. One and all, thank you very much. In the meantime, like I said, have a wonderful weekend. And Moran Monday will be around sooner than we know it, and there'll probably be Morans running around all weekend long. If you're somewhere that it's cold, stay warm. If you're somewhere that it's warm, stay cool. Thanks go out to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox, who's done really wonderful things with the website lately. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always go out to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHEACT, ACHEACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. And here comes Rick Smith on the horn.